Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractors Business Presentation of the Month. This monthly CV web series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of teaching contractors how to run profitable businesses. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry shares dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. Change is good, so this month's presentation by Pat Johns is a bit different. Pat is a world adventurer that has the ability to relate his accomplishments back to usable business principles. This presentation will actually be an interview with Pat discussing highlights of some of his accomplishments and then relating it back to five footprints to success. As a special bonus, Pat has provided a bonus section at the end called Live from the Himalayan 100. It's our hope that this presentation will encourage you to do a few things that perhaps you might not try to do otherwise.
Hello, my name is Geraldine Van Arnhem, and I'm here today talking to Pat Johns. Before I introduce Pat, let's just take a minute and listen to some appropriate words as read by the voice of Alex Burton.
The following is taken from the introduction of Pat's book, Footprints in the Shadow of Giants, The Race to the Center Within. The first footprint that you make when leaving your comfort zone is the most important step you will ever take. It is the beginning of your awakening to a new perception of yourself. It's a footprint that can never be erased. It is a symbol of your commitment to walk, fly, think, or run into the unknown to find that part of yourself that you have never challenged to the extreme. Each footprint you make towards that goal will change your life and will remain embedded in the experience of those who wondered why as you pass them by, long after you have reached the center within.
Long after you have reached the center within. Wow, that's so nice. How are you, Pat?
I'm just fine, Geraldine. Okay. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, and thank you so much for joining us. Let me first tell our listeners a little bit about your colorful and diverse background.
Okay.
Okay. You're a professional speaker and a leadership trainer, an author, a global adventurist, and an international photojournalist. Actually, I'm looking at your book, Pat. It looks absolutely incredible.
Oh, thank you. My book is called Footprints in the Shadow of Giants, The Race to the Center Within, and much of it is based in my travel to India, and it's the first of a series of books. My next one will be based in Africa. Thank you.
Fantastic. Super, super. Okay, now you have 30 years of corporate experience, mm-hmm. and I understand you were recently featured on Fox TV as an authority on leadership and perseverance. You're considered to be an elite endurance athlete and have run over 60 ultramarathons and marathons around the globe and are currently the only one in the world to have completed in and finished the Himalayan 100-mile running race. Not just once, but four times. Now, let me get this straight. This is a high-altitude 100-mile running race that takes place every year in the Himalayan mountains near the border between India and Nepal. Wow. That's a lot. So what do you do in your spare time, Pat?
I joke about this because a lot of the events that I attend, there's a golf outing that are associated with them if it's a corporate speaking event that I'm doing, and I don't have much time to play golf. I like golf, but I don't have time to play golf. I'd substitute that with other things.
I understand. Okay. Okay, so for starters, please tell us about the Himalayan 100-mile race and share with us what has been your experience with this event.
The Himalayan 100 is a 105-mile run that takes place every year. The event is billed by many as being the most beautiful event in the world because for much of the race, it's the four of the five world's tallest peaks are visible. But I really like to emphasize that my story is not about running. It's more a story about how people change when they choose to do difficult things. And it begins like this. In the early 1900s, the Aga Khan, who ruled much of India, said, "Build me a trail." You see, the Aga Khan had heard of a place. In fact, it's the only place in the world where it's possible to see four giants. And he wanted a way to get there. The Aga Khan, he wanted a way to see for himself. The giants are four of the five world's tallest peaks, Mount Everest, Lhotse, Makalu, and Mount Kanchenjunga. in much of the Himalayan 100 is run on the Aga Khan's old trail, which is also in part the border between India and Nepal. Now, in 2000, I first did the Himalayan 100, and then after the tragic events of 9/11, the government of India invited me back as a journalist to write about the race and to encourage Americans to get back out and travel again. So I returned to India in 2003, then again in 2004, and then again in 2005. And the race is very scenic, but it's also thought to be one of the more challenging courses in the world.
I'm sure. All right. Can you set the stage on how this can help us in our personal and professional lives? Where would you like to begin this interesting discussion?
I can, and it's with this fascinating concept, and it goes like this, that every second our senses, our five senses, are exposed to literally billions of bits of information. Now, that's the good news. You might call that our mental menu. We're exposed to all of this data. In fact, if you write that number down, 400 billion bits of information we're exposed to every second. Well, here's the bad news. The bad news is that our brains only have the ability to process at the rate of about 2,000. The story actually gets worse because of those 2,000 bits of information that we pick from, much of that is based on our belief systems, and it's based on our traditional cultural values and those types of things. And guess what? It's just wrong. And the problem with that is that most of us, not only do we choose the wrong information from the 400 billion bits of information, but we choose information that basically supports our traditional belief system. And what I advise people to do, because our traditional belief system is really based on, you might say it's based on limits versus abundance, I encourage people to focus on two keywords, opportunity and abundance. And the bottom line to this is that if we just take the time to look at things differently or look for different things, then we can expand our horizons and do things in our life that we otherwise would have thought to be impossible.
Yeah. Okay. Can you give us an example of the type of limits within our belief system that you're referring to?
One traditional story that falls into this category is the story of the 4-minute mile. And an amazing thing happened. It was believed for many, many years that no one would ever be able to run a 4-minute mile. And then as soon as someone ran a 4-minute mile for the first time, then it became possible for other people to do that. What had happened was a traditional belief system that this was an impossible thing to do was shattered, basically. And then once people believed that they could do it, then other people were able to step up to the plate and do it. And another example of this is really the story of ultra running in the first place. The idea of running a marathon and then running another marathon and doing 5 marathons in a row to some people seems like a very difficult thing, because for most people, after they've run a marathon, they can barely walk the next day. But the key here is that if you believe you can do it, then you're with a group of people and everybody gets themselves out of bed in the morning and they go and do it. And almost miraculously, it's amazing how important the mind is in this formula.
Yeah. Pat, the 5 C's you speak about really represents your core message. What are the 5 C's?
Well, the 5 C's are a strategy that I developed in returning to the Himalayan 100. I've always been interested in the in behavioral science and wanting to understand the core values and the motives of the people who do this race. So I actually went to the event with the intention of studying the core values of these people, and in doing so, I developed my 5C strategy. So for starters, the 5 C's are first, a willingness to leave one's comfort zone. The second C is staying committed to one's goals. The third is connecting with those around you. Fourth, use common sense. And the fifth and most important C is do all of this with an attitude of compassion, not just for the other person, but for yourself too. We have to care about ourselves.
Where did the 5 C's originate from?
It's an interesting story. In 2000, prior to going to India for the first time to do the Himalayan 100, I had run the Pikes Peak Marathon 3 times. And the Pikes Peak Marathon is a rather difficult race. It's up the Bar Trail from about 6,000 feet to 14,000 feet. And first night in India, I had my Pikes Peak Marathon cap on, and I went down to dinner and met the people at the table with me. And this one couple to my right, John and Janine, I introduced myself. I'm proud to be wearing my Pikes Peak Marathon cap. And they said, well, we just ran the Iditarod. I said, ran the Iditarod? Oh, you have dogs? And they said, no, we did it on foot. These people had run 1,100 miles in 41 days, 35 below, pulling their own sleds. And I looked to my left, this German guy, Stefan. He said, Stefan, what's your story? And he said, oh, I just did Deca Ironman. And this guy had done a 1,200-mile bike ride, a 262-mile run, and a 30-mile ocean swim. And so what do you think I did with my Pikes Peak Marathon cap? That, it went right back in the bag. But see, what this did, though, was it gave me a real clear indication that I had an opportunity to root around in the noodles of these incredible people who do this race. And if I could encapsulate the spirit of these people and what motivated them, and that's where the five C's were developed, and I thought I can put that together and come back and share the story of the five C's with the people that I speak to.
Can you explain how the five C's work, Pat?
Well, I think the best way to do that would be to share a story about each. We'll start out with a story about comfort zone. And I'll tell a tale of a friend of mine named Noel Hanna from Ireland. And Noel is a retired firefighter that lives in Northern Ireland. And I met Noel in 2003, and this is probably one of the toughest people that I've ever met. And we were getting ready to have a blizzard one of the days of the Himalayan 100, and I looked to Noel, and I said, Noel, what do you think about this weather? And he said, bring it on, because, you see, Noel realized that the harder you made the conditions, the better he would do, because he just believed that he was tougher than anyone around it. What he had learned to do was he had learned to replace the feelings of fear with some other thought. See, we're conditioned. This goes back to the way we're programmed. And we're conditioned to believe that fear is a bad thing, when in fact fear is what we want to encourage and we want to celebrate in our lives, because when we do that, when we're feeling the feelings of fear, if we're aware of what they are, let's say we use that as part of our emotional navigation system, when we feel fear rather than thinking that fear is a bad thing, we can change the way we look at it and say, oh, this is perfect, because now I'm on the right track for growing and learning new things and evolving and developing. So Noel had a handle on that, and that's really what leaving one's comfort zone is all about. The second story I'll tell has to do with commitment. And in 2000, my friend Ed and I were two of about eight people from the area that had agreed to go to India that year. And this is where accountability comes into the story. At the end of the day, there were actually only two of us who went from the group of eight, and it was Ed and I. And the reason we did it was because we had held each other accountable. I said to Ed, I'll go to India, and he said, I'm going to do this too. And accountability and partnership is the key. Commitments is making those commitments and not being afraid to step up to the plate and say, I'm going to do this. That's what commitment's all about. The third C is connections. And let me tell you why connections are especially important, especially moving into our most recent economy. Because of computers and outsourcing to Asia, a lot of the linear processes that have been so highly regarded in the past are having to move aside for relationship building and things, because, you see, you can't outsource relationships. So it's those connections with the people that we deal with every day that is going to help guarantee our future. So connections with the people, that's not to say networking in terms of what can you do for me, but networking more in terms of being in service and saying, what can I do for you? That's connections. Common sense kind of speaks for itself. You need proper conditioning and proper training and staying focused on what your objectives are. But the most important C is compassion. And the story that I like to tell to illustrate compassion, and you might wonder what this has to do with compassion, but in 2005, when I returned to India, There was another gentleman there that was doing the race for the fourth time. And you see, I went there to be the only one in the world to do this four times because as a professional speaker, it was good on my resume. And I knew this could help me. Well, the other gentleman wasn't quite as happy to see me as I was to see him, and he continued to be quite ugly, and I kept telling myself, I'm going to take the high road with this guy, and I did. And then at 96 miles, with only 4 miles to go in the race, I looked off to the left, and here he sits. He had tripped over his own feet and fallen and dislocated his shoulder and wasn't able to finish, and so what do you think I thought? Yeah, not pretty, you know. And of course, that's our humanness coming to the surface. That's our ego that says, yeah, you know, make the story about me. And where compassion comes into this part of the story is we need to be aware of the fact that as humans, we're always wanting to make the story about ourselves. But the important thing is that we correct off of that and keep coming back to the fact that we're really here to help the other person and to make a mental correction. And that's really where compassion comes into the story. So those are the five C's. It's a willingness to leave your comfort zone, making commitments, connecting with the people around you, using common sense, all with an attitude of compassion. That's the key. Those are the 5C strategy that I believe will help us do amazing things in our lives.
I'm familiar that to complete a 100-mile marathon, you have to sustain the most extreme conditions, taking your body to total depletion. Pat, if you were to put a percentage on it, what percentage would you attribute to the physiology of your body, and what percentage would you attribute to the strength of your mind?
Oh, that is such a good question.
Thank you.
I believe that the more lofty the goal is, the more the mental side comes into the picture. Most people who have done amazing things in their life haven't necessarily known how they were going to do them. They just knew that they were. And it's through that confidence and it's that belief. And that part of it is all mental. Of course, there's always the room for plenty of preparation and plenty of training and the physical side of it. But at the end of the day, it always comes down to the mental side. It's all about believing. This is where belief comes in. When you truly believe that you can do something, then amazing things can happen. So I would say to answer your question that it definitely is weighted well in favor of belief.
Yeah. Okay, and in my opinion, one of the most important ingredients in anyone's success is consistency. How consistent is your training leading up to a marathon, and do you follow the same habits as it pertains to business?
I think I do. I like to refer to myself as a plotter, and I'm pretty good at just plodding along, grinding away at the trail. And the Himalayan 100, one of the aspects of the race that makes it challenging is because you're at such a high altitude, you can see for a long ways. And the problem when you're able to see a long expanse of a trail or an event, or it might even be your annual goal, it might be a long-term project, is if you look at the whole project all at once, then you'll become overwhelmed with it. And the Himalayan 100 is very difficult for this. I joke that you never want to drive a marathon course prior to running the marathon, because if you have to sit in a car for 26 miles, then more than likely you won't want to run it because you're going to be so intimidated with what it seems to represent.
Yeah.
So consistency is the key, and just grinding away and plugging away at it and breaking it down into more manageable bite-sized chunks. You know, the old adage of how to eat an elephant, eat it one bite at a time. That really applies to question.
Okay. In making a decision, would you recommend using your mind or your heart? So basically stating, would you use logic or emotion to make a decision?
Well, there's a great book written by Malcolm Gladwell on this topic. It's called Blank. And in Blank, Mr. Gladwell makes a very valid point that the majority of the information that we need to make a decision, our instincts tell us immediately upon that encounter. So we walk into a situation and our instincts, our gut tells us what it is that is right or wrong or the best decision. But what's happened, and part of this is just part of our society, is we become a society of information gatherers. And quite often, at that point, we start gathering more information. And really, it's more information than we need because we knew the right thing to do in the first place. So I encourage people to return back to the basics and start trusting their instincts more often and really go with their gut. I think the instinctive reaction to a situation probably gives you more information or at least enough information to make that decision.
Okay. Now, you're a very interesting man, Pat, who has accomplished great things. Would you consider yourself a role model?
I think responsible adults should all consider ourselves to be role models. It doesn't really have to do with one person's choices about whether or not they're going to do events that put them in the public eye and the limelight or professional athletes. I just believe that because modeling behavior is the key here, that if we want to continue to evolve, if we want to continue to grow, if we want to continue becoming more of whatever it is that we want and have those around us become greater and become more of what they want, the key is that we need to model those types of behaviors. So I think the best answer to that is that if we view ourselves as being role models and wanting to model proper behavior in any situation for those around us, it really is the best way to teach, too, is if people see you modeling good behavior, then more than likely they'll pick up on it themselves. You know, something really simple about this and not so much tied to being a role model, but just the idea of putting a smile on your face. Mm-hmm. Talk about it. If you want to gain control of a situation, you be the one to start smiling and then it's like everybody else does it. You know, so you can look at the simple things like putting a smile on your face. If that being a role model or possibly, you know, conducting yourself in a responsible way. But I think we all have a responsibility to model good behavior.
Now, I've seen your program and have heard you talk about what I believe you refer to as the motivational hierarchy. I found that to be fascinating, yet so simple. Can you share that concept mm-hmm. with us?
Yeah, it really is. This is so simple, but it is so usable. And it's based on a study that uses three key words to describe our actions. And the three words are compliant, obligated, and committed. And if you stop and think about how simple this is, every action that we take, we can plug ourselves into one of those three categories. We are either compliant, obligated, or committed. And if you know where you are, it's easier to navigate yourself to become committed. See, of course, the key is to do everything that you're able to do with a feeling of commitment. But unless you stop and realize that maybe maybe your actions are because you're simply complying with a rule or you're obligated to other people and not necessarily committed, then you don't have an opportunity as clearly to grow into commitment. So the motivational hierarchy is basically the idea that when you understand or try to understand people's behaviors, which ultimately is to set expectations of what you hope to see other people do or yourself do, that if you can plug yourself in there and realize that quite often you're not operating from a state of commitment, you're operating because you're simply complying, then there's an opportunity there to grow yourself and to move towards commitment. And the key here, the biggest question that I have when we do workshops with corporations that are dealing with, you might say, commitment issues, is, well, how do you get people to feel more committed? And the answer is simple, and it's always the same. It's gratitude. It's the idea of making sure that we find value with what others are doing and make people feel appreciated and be grateful for them. That will always shift people more towards committed. 65% of people who leave jobs leave because they feel they have been underappreciated. So if the question is, how do you get people to commit to be more committed, the answer is always the same. It's by showing sincere, that's the key word, sincere gratitude for the work and the actions of the people around you.
Okay. Now, Pat, if you boiled all this down to one basic lesson, let's say one bottom line, core point, what would that lesson be?
Well, I'd like to go back and borrow from my friend Noel, who had that ability to replace his understanding of the word fear, because I believe this is just so important that if we can stop treating certain words like fear or joy or gratitude or smiling as nebulous words, if we can start treating those words as if those thoughts are actually things and make them tangible, then they become more meaningful tools. The word fear, I believe, when we feel fear, if we can just stop ourselves and take a breath and say, you know, how am I right now? And understand that I'm, you know, actually doing pretty well right now, and that the only thing that I'm fearful of is the unknown of the future. See, we spend a whole lot of time being fearful of the future and feeling remorse or regrets or concerns about our past instead of focusing on the most important thing, which is where am I right now and how am I doing right now? So I like to encourage people to put themselves in situations where they do feel fear. And when they feel fear, go, oh, that's right on. I'm right on track. I'm growing. I'm learning. I'm bringing new material, new experiences into my life. And to do that, so celebrate fear. I think that would be the celebrate the fears in our lives. That would be the core bottom line to all of this.
Tell me, Pat, what does the future hold in store for you? And what's in your vision?
Well, we're doing a lot of work in Africa, and I'm working on my second book. My second book is called Echoes Through the Great Rift Valley, The Road to Livingstonia, and it's similar in ways to my Footprints book, which is based on stories from India, but my Echoes book is based on our experience in Africa.
Wow. Oh, wow. What type of work are you going to be doing in Africa?
Well, I'm working with several organizations, and we're providing water for the, this is a pretty startling statistic, but there are approximately 6,000 children a day die from a lack of either safe and drinkable water or from a lack of sanitation. So we're working on doing something about that. I'm working with a group of people to rehab a 100-year-old water system in Livingstonia, Africa. And so we're primarily focused on doing our part to deliver safe water for the people in Africa.
Oh, okay. Well, Pat, thank you so much for sharing your message with us. Now, to close our discussion, we would like to play for our audience the program that you recorded while you were actually in India at the Himalayan 100 Mile. But before we do, can you give us the background on this project?
Well, what I did was I was asked by one of the radio stations that I work with to bring a digital recording device with me. And along the Himalayan 100 course, I recorded about 100 different sound bites. And then we took all that information live from the Himalayan 100 and then went into the studio and engineered the piece that you're getting ready to hear here, which is a first-person narrative written live from the Himalayan 100. In the early 1900s, the Aga Khan, who ruled much of India, gave an order. He said, "Build me a trail." He had heard of a place where it was possible to see four giants, and he wanted a way to get there, a way to see for himself. The giants are four of the tallest peaks in the world, Mount Everest, Lhotse, Makalu, and Mount Kanchenjunga. Much of the Himalayan 100 race is run on the Khan's old trail, which also serves as the border between India and Nepal. For the last 15 years, this race and this trail have attracted some of the world's most elite endurance runners. As an athlete and motivational speaker, I first came here in 2000 to understand the core values of this highly motivated group. I discovered what I call the 5 C's, leaving your comfort zone, commitment, connections, common sense, and compassion. This year, I want to validate the inspirational talk that I've crafted around these 5 C's. I'm in Manibanjang, a small hamlet village in the West Bengal region of India, and the locals have come out to serenade us and to tie prayer scarves around our necks. I know we're going to need all the prayers we can get, as this group of 70 competitors, the biggest group ever, gathers at the starting line on this cold October morning.
Ready, set, go!
Stage one is 24 miles, an 8,000-foot climb up to 13,000 feet, the highest altitude of the race. On the cobble trail with me are two great buddies from the U.S., Hank Bayshore, an investment broker and chairman of the board of the American Red Cross of Dallas, and Aaron LaBarge, a brilliant physicist from San Diego. Our own little team of three, adding to the headcount of a dozen Americans. We've also convinced Nan Eyrick, a journalist from Virginia, to at least run on day one, since it'll make for a better story for her. Nan is generally on board with my five core values, but isn't sure if compassion plays a part in such a competitive environment. She'll soon find out. About 5 miles into the race, Hank Bayshore gets into trouble. He urges us to go on.
We're just a bit concerned. This is our friend Hank. Hank, he was sick last night. He had to fall back. Stopped early on. And hope he's okay.
We later learn that when Nan Eyrick starts to feel the altitude, cold, and dehydration, it's Hank who stays with her and gets her to the finish line 2 hours after we've crossed it. Every time I do this race, I can't believe how hard it is. Funny how our minds forget the pain. It must be a survival mechanism, part of the human condition. Aaron and I have made a pact to stay together for the entire 100 miles if possible. This first day, it was a bonus to have him by my side. Misery loves company.
You get about 1K left and feeling quite a bit wobbly would be the best way, yeah?
Yeah, wobbly, definitely wobbly.
Yeah. Getting there now.
Here they are! Way to go, guys.
Brilliant.
We've been waiting. What took you so long?
It's day three, the Mount Everest Challenge Marathon. Waking up comes easily because sleep did not, in a cold, heatless hut at 13,000 feet, crowded in with 20 other coughing, gagging, and wheezing runners. This year, as a gift for my hut mates, I brought a round of earplugs for everyone, and it did seem to help. Time to grab my camera for the first glimpse of Everest and the other three giants.
Name's David.
David, where are you from?
I'm from the UK.
I'm standing with one of the lead runners, David Buttram, with my coffee in hand.
At the moment, it's 5:20 in the morning. The sky's completely clear.
How about those clouds?
They look like some Mad Beatles album cover, don't they?
Okay, ready, run, set, go!
Yay! We start the 26-plus mile run at 13,000 feet and then descend into the jungle. The waterfalls and insects are in sharp contrast to the cold and barren rocky trail up high. We're running down a muddy creek and lose 5,000 vertical feet of altitude, slogging the last 10 miles through slop, just trying not to fall. The previous day's run had been a 20-mile out-and-back course. Hank pushed himself and made up some of the time that he had lost on the first day.
Good job.
Good job.
Looking good.
We pass through a few villages, and as they do every year, all the kids leave their classrooms to come and watch. We exchange greetings.
Namaste.
Namaste is a Hindi word which carries great significance, and we hear it a lot. It's a special way to wish good things to others.
We're just finishing the last 6/10 of a mile of the marathon day. How are you feeling?
More. I'm feeling like my bones are just going to fall out of my skin.
Ready to be over?
Yes, soon.
Perspective at this point is all out of whack. There have been a lot of injuries, everything from convulsions to broken bones, but at the end of the 13-mile sprint on the fourth day, all of us seek refreshment at a cultural night put on by the local villagers and musicians. The people here are sheltered from the world but are eager to show us theirs.
A
Okay, we've just been joined by our third compadre from the U.S. here. Hank, good morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Doing fine. Feeling good. Looking forward to the last day.
Yeah.
Actually, I am. It's kind of weird. I mean, looking forward for 17.
Over. I feel used up. But Aaron and I fulfill our goal of running the entire 100 miles together. He and Hank are exhausted, but elated.
It was a spiritual experience for me. It brought me closer to the people that live here in India, and also to nature, and to myself.
This has been the most incredible experience. This is the hardest thing I've ever done.
In 4 years of running this race, I'm always amazed at how similar participants' reactions are. But this story isn't about running 100 miles high up in the Himalayan mountains. It's about how people change when they choose to do difficult things. Leaving your comfort zone and connecting compassionately with others is powerful, and it carries over into all aspects of our lives. No doubt that's why I keep coming back. I like to witness that. I guess that's how I change.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's presentation. Feel free to give us a call with your comments, or if you prefer, you may fax or email our office. Remember, if you're serious about putting systems into place, you just might want to attend Grandy & Associates' 3-day Basic Business Bootcamp. Check out our website for all the details at www.grandyassociates.com or call us at 1-800-432-7963. The Service Contractors Business Presentation of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.